Ahoy, mateys! Welcome to the GameBuoy.org video game podcast, your twice-monthly port of call for gaming news and views that maybe aren't on your radar, but most definitely should be. I'm your host, Captain Spike, and with me, as always, is First Mate Slagkick.
Yarr!
Today is May 24th, 2015, and this is episode 80, Marvel Madness.
Marvel Madness?
Marvel Madness.
Oh...
I usually name episodes after songs, and in this particular case, I didn't, because I liked that wordplay. In any event, welcome again, our lovely and beautiful listeners, to another episode of the GameBuoy.org video game podcast.
GameBuoy.org video game podcast.
This week, we're going to be taking a look at the universe of Marvel Comics video games. So, buckle in and get ready for that. But first, we have our usual slate of follow-ups and news bits. Slaggy, this first one is one that's real important to both of us. Why don't you get us started? Although, obviously, I will have something to say as well.
What a wonderful night to have at KS, decided Koji Igarashi-san, because we finally got Bloodstained Ritual of the Night, which is the spiritual successor to the Igavania Castlevanias, and... it looks wonderful. I'm going to let you elaborate.
Well, the TLDR is that this is a Kickstarter posted by Koji Igarashi-san, and the TLDR is sort of that Igarashi-san is working with Intic Creates, whom we've talked about a lot here on the show due to their connection to the Mega Man series, particularly with regard to, you know, Mega Man Zero and sort of the Mega Man 9 and 10 revival games. Obviously, they're heavily involved in Mighty Number 9 as well, which is, very similar to what Bloodstained is doing, except Mighty Number 9 is... for the Mega Man fandom. Basically, Igarashi-san is going to make the ultimate Igavania, is basically his plan here. Igavania is the term that he's using for what we typically describe as, you know, the Metroidvania-style game, and more specifically, his set of Castlevania games. Initially, Igarashi-san was looking for $500,000 to be pledged to make Bloodstained Ritual of the Night. The funding so far, with 19 days to go, is well past the 2.5 million mark.
Yes.
And something interesting about this Kickstarter is that it's actually being done as a proof of concept. He actually was able to find about $5 million worth of funding for this game, but in order for the publisher that he's working with to give him that money, he needed to prove that there was fan demand for this game.
Oh.
And he discusses this very openly in the Kickstarter pitch video. Some people are super against Kickstarter being used that way, but for me, the publisher needed hard proof that people were willing to pay money for a game like this before they put money into it. So to me, this is the perfect use for Kickstarter. It's a game that could not exist any other way, and yet with the talent working on it that is working on it, it will certainly get made, assuming they get the money. There's not going to be some run out. There's not going to be anyone, you know, refunding money or keeping the money and disappearing off the face of the earth. Like, no, Bloodstained is going to exist. It's going to be the ultimate Metroidvania. And at this point, all we need to do is wait for its proposed 2017 release date.
Aw, man.
Yeah, that's the one thing, is that, like, I appreciate that good games take time, but man, I don't want to wait that long.
I don't want to wait.
Yeah. So far, we don't know a whole lot, per se, about how, like, the ability systems in the game are going to work, but the game does have a, like, stained glass window theme to it. The main character is an alchemist named Miriam, who was cursed with, some kind of, like, cursed disease that causes her skin to become stained glass. It's very reminiscent of the story of Shanoa from Order of Ecclesia, with her cursed glyphs and everything. So, in any event, game looks exciting. A lot of people very excited for this Kickstarter. I'm certainly over the moon. And probably by the time you're listening to this show, they will have had more of their stretch goals hit. There's been some amazing stuff already.
Oh my god, right?
Like, there's gonna be, like, an 8-bit style level. There's gonna be a whole extra game mode that is done in the style of classic Castlevanias.
It's basically two Castlevanias in one.
Right? Obviously, boss rush mode, speed run modes, extra bosses, two-player co-op, David Hayter as a voice actor, multiple playable characters. So it's just, the game really, it looks like it is going to be the ultimate Metroidvania. I'm really excited about it, and you're probably going to hear about it a whole lot more on this show over the next year.
You bet. Activision has announced the next batch of... Activision has announced the next set of songs for Guitar Hero Live. This time... revealing some heavy metal-ish sorts of things, including Marilyn Manson, Disposable Teens, Deftones, Diamond Eyes, and other stuff that I don't particularly care for, Killswitch Engage, Bring Me the Horizon, Mastodon, Trivian of Mice and Men.
So the whole list is Royal Blood, Little Monster, Marilyn Manson, Disposable Teens, Killswitch Engage, In Due Time, Marmosets, Move, Shake, Hide, Of Mice and Men, Bones Exposed, Deftones, Diamond Eyes, Vista Chino, Sweet Remain, Bring Me the Horizon, Shadow Moses, Mastodon, High Road, and Trivium, Strife.
I think they're called Trivium.
Well, okay. Good on them. We also have word here that
okay, but wait,
Kingdom
is
Hearts...
Is the song Shadow Moses a reference to Metal Gear?
It very likely could be.
That makes me kind of want to look into that.
We also have the announcement from Square Enix of Kingdom Hearts Unchained Key for smartphones.
Oh, clever. Unchained Key.
This is, of course, a up port of the previously Japan-only browser title Kingdom Hearts Key. This, Square Enix has discussed, is very specifically being developed with a worldwide release in mind, so I would anticipate that sometime after the Japanese 2015 release for Android and iOS, we will be getting Kingdom Hearts Unchained Key in other parts of the world.
Lovely. IGN did an interview with Guillermo del Toro. And they were talking to him about, you know, the cancellation of Silent Hills. And he said, what we wanted to do with the game, and we were very much in agreement on this, was to take the technology and make it as cutting edge as we could and create a terror in the house. The idea was very, very atmosphere-drenched. And he's basically just kind of burnt out on the, you know, the whole situation that's evolved here.
Yeah, you know, between this and Insane, it's just, I can't really blame the guy. But to me, losing him as a potential voice in video games is really tragic, because, you know, I think of Guillermo del Toro as, like, a visionary artist who has, like, a really keen grasp on, like, visual presentation and atmosphere, and those are things that I really think are very beneficial in video game design, particularly relating to sort of more cinematic and narrative-based experiences, which is typically what you see from the survival horror genre. So I think this is a real loss, and I really hope that, you know, if he does work on anything else, that it pans out, because I think it would be a real shame to lose him as a potential voice in gaming.
Yeah.
We also have word that the update to Final Fantasy XV Episode Dusk is going to be coming in early June. This is, of course, going to be like both a balance patch and a bug patch, while also including tweaks to the battle system, the way the camera works, and even adding some new content. So this was, you know, the version 2.0 of the demo that Hajime Tabata-san talked about during the Episode Dusk live stream last month.
Nice.
Initially, it was meant to release in May, but obviously they missed their window, and we'll be getting it in early June.
You know, I'm not familiar enough with, like, the history of game demos to be familiar, but I like this approach of, oh, we're going to keep iterating on the demo to show off the developments instead of just being like, oh, here's a demo, here's a completely different demo, or whatever.
You know, I don't know that it's super, super common, but Square Enix has been doing this somewhat recently. Most famously, probably, was that they took a very similar tack for this in the release of the demos for the first Bravely Default game. That ended up having, like, 4 demos, which were very iterative, and they took a lot of fan feedback, and, you know, the final product of the game really was very different from that first demo. The game design grew a lot and got a lot sharper, got polished. I definitely think that Square Enix is doing some interesting stuff in that field, if we're being really honest. I know it's popular to shit on Square Enix, but I can't bring myself to when it comes to weird demo iteration strategies.
Yeah.
We also have word here that Mistwalker has updated the strategy RPG Terra Battle on iOS and Android. It now includes a new chapter, as well as features that were unlocked as stretch goals in the game's download starter campaign. You know, somewhat exciting for someone like myself, of course, is that the content that we unlocked from the download starter is that Yasunori Mitsuda-san did some music for the game. Obviously, we're huge fans of Mitsuda-san here in the studio. But also exciting is a new daily quest called The Hedgehog Hullabaloo, which features character designs by Naota Oshima-san, who is the artist who designed the look of Sonic the Hedgehog. Obviously, Terra Battle is free to play. It's available now on iOS and Android. And I have to say, you know, I'm a big fan of it. I think it's a great game, and I may start dipping back into it with this update.
Yeah. And speaking of updates, Towerfall Dark World is now available for PS4 and PC. The Vita version is unfortunately still in the works, but if you are a fan of Towerfall, you definitely want to pick this up. It has a ton of new things, like 10 new archers, 4 level sets, procedurally generated levels, a new co-op mode, boss battles, new power-ups. One of these bosses, and I don't know if you've said this before, but like, one of these bosses in the screenshot over on Silk Clown Era makes me think of a Castlevania boss. It's like a big eyeball.
I have not said that before, but you're definitely right. And if you're not a fan of Towerfall, to follow on what Slykick was saying, what are you doing with your life?
Basically.
I'm downloading this right now.
Yeah, I want to play as, like, the Amanita Sarkeesian archer.
Well, I know what we're doing tonight. We also have word that Sega has made good on their word, as promised earlier this month, and they have removed many of their mobile games from the iOS App Store, the Google Play Store, the Samsung App Store, and the Amazon App Store in the last week or so. The games that have been pulled so far include Virtua Fighter 2, which was based on that awful Genesis port of Virtua Fighter 2, Space Harrier 2, the Streets of Rage 1 and 3 pack, the Golden Axe 1, 2, and 3 pack, Phantasy Star 2, Echo the Dolphin, Altered Beast, Super Monkey Ball, Tip and Tilt 1 and 2, Super Monkey Ball 1 and 2, Jet Set Radio, and Afterburner Climax. Sega has added, as we discussed, that, you know, if you own the games already, they are going to remain available until your phone stops supporting them effectively, which, you know, we definitely applauded them for here on the show. But, obviously, you know, it always sucks when you see games removed from the marketplace, even when they're shitty games. So, Sega has said, you know, that some of these games may be coming back in updated forms. Hopefully that stands, and the only one they don't bring back is Virtua Fighter 2, because that port never should have existed in the first place.
Yeah.
Have you played that, Saigi? That Genesis port? That Genesis port of Virtua Fighter 2?
No, because that sounds like a shit show.
Yeah, you're quite right. It is a shit show. Saigi, why don't you take this one?
Alright, so Games Master talked to Eric Dodds, the director of Blizzard's Hearthstone, and Dodds was talking about, you know, just the future of Hearthstone and kind of just the how at Blizzard they're trying to work out, you know, how to keep this a sustainable model and, you know, maintain the long-term health of the game. You know, he doesn't want to just keep having new cards. So those of you who are huge fans of Hearthstone and are, you know, wanting to play it for a long, long, long time to come, that's Blizzard's goal, and they're, you know, definitely working hard to find ways to make the game compelling for years to come.
Excellent, excellent. All right, and with that, we have some release date updates for y'all. First off, we have news that Guilty Gear XX Accent Core Plus R is going to be coming to PC via Steam. This is going to be hitting Steam on Tuesday, May 26th, so around the time you can start hearing this episode. We also have word from Capcom that the Devil May Cry 4 Special Edition is going to be releasing on PC, Xbox One, and PlayStation 4 on June 23rd. We've also got word that LEGO Jurassic World will be releasing on June 12th, as well as the somewhat fun news that the Hyperdimension Neptunia Rebirth 2 Sisters Generation PC port has been bumped up to May 29th.
Ooh.
And, much like the first game in the series, the game will cost $20.99 normally, but will be 50% off for the first week.
Yay!
I picked the first game up for 50% off in its first week and got really into it, possibly because I felt like it was a game that was worth $15. And, you know, in light of that, I will definitely be picking up Neptunia Rebirth 2 for $15. Last, but certainly not least, we also have word that Hyperdimension Neptunia Rebirth 3 V-Century will be released on Vita on July 3rd in Europe and June 30th in North America.
Man, go Neptunia.
Yeah, right? Saigi, unless you have anything else, I think it might be time for some news.
Nope, let's do it.
Oh my god.
News. Oh my god. News. The wildly successful mobile RPG Monster Strike is on its way to Nintendo 3DS, according to Mixi President Hiroki Morita-san during a financial results briefing. This is also going to be coming with an anime adaptation in Japan.
Oh, wow. That's great. You know, it's funny because Monster Strike was a huge hit in Japan. I know that it had, you know, quite a few English language downloads as well. So it's, you know, it's not surprising to me that it's getting a 3DS port, but I'm surprised that it's getting an anime because it doesn't have, like, any kind of real story or any kind of characters other than the monsters.
Maybe it'll just be monsters being cute.
Hey, I would be down for that. In other really exciting news, Gung Ho Online has announced that Grandia 2 is going to be getting a remastered release on Steam.
Wow.
The Steam version of the game is being released following feedback from a survey that subsidiary Game Arts conducted back in April. The Steam version is going to use the Dreamcast release as a base and will include HD visuals, as well as support for mouse and keyboard controls, along with Steam achievements and Steam trading cards. I'm a big fan of the Grandia series. I think Grandia 2 was the best game in the series. This is definitely something to keep your eyes on.
That's great.
During this year's fiscal year earnings call over at Ubisoft, they announced that except for Just Dance, all of Ubi's upcoming games will only be released on the current-gen platforms. No more Xbox 360 and PS3 ports moving forward.
I think that's pretty fair.
I definitely would agree. On a related note, Ubisoft has announced the next Assassin's Creed game. This one is called Syndicate, and it will be out for PS4 and Xbox One on October 23rd, with a PC release coming later in the fall. Something that's really exciting is that the game will allow you to select your protagonist at the beginning of the game, and it will feature both male and female protagonists. As well as that, it's going to be putting a lot of emphasis on like movement abilities and enhancing abilities that we're already familiar with, including such items as a grappling hook gun that will work sort of Batman style. So they're clearly stepping into some sort of more game-centered experimental concepts.
Yeah.
And I have to say, for me, I'm actually excited about this. I mean, I know I get excited about every Assassin's Creed and then end up disappointed by how much of a shit show they are.
Right.
But so far, this one looks pretty good, and it looks like it has some genuinely good, fresh ideas for the series.
Yeah, I only have a problem with the fact that on, like, the promotional art, you know, you mentioned that there is a female and a male protagonist this time around. They are brother and sister Jacob and Evie Fry, but in all of the promotional art, Jacob is front and center, and Evie's like a little bit off to the side. I'm like, why that gotta be that way?
Sad truth, because that's what the average gamer will respond to better.
But I guess
there are people who avoid games that have playable female
characters. I guess at least, you know, if that's like indicative of what the cover art's like, then, you know, at least she's on the cover, you know?
Yeah, right.
And I don't know, maybe your information's more current than mine. My impression was that you'd play as both, kind of like just alternating depending on story missions, but that for free, like free play mode that you could choose whoever you want.
You know, my read of it was definitely that it was a selectable protagonist situation, but, you know, I could definitely be wrong.
Yeah, what I'm aware of at this point is that, you know, anything that's involving like a mission will have whoever the mission is kind of starring, but when you're just off doing, like, you know, exploring and rando quests, that you would be able to select whoever.
All right, that's
which
interesting.
Which means I'm going to be like, yeah, AV Fry, what up?
Last week, Nintendo stealth released a new intelligent systems designed Pushmo game.
Like, all you had to say was intelligent systems, and I was like, yay!
This is actually a free-to-play Pushmo game. And something that I thought was really cool is that, you know, in addition to the tried-and-true Pushmo mechanics, it also brought some new mechanics to the table. And most interestingly, the first set of stages are a free download. And then you just buy what are basically expansions for additional content, with each little, like, $5 expansion being about the size of the old Pushmo games. So I feel, you know, this is probably somewhat indicative of what we're going to see from Nintendo on their mobile front when they start designing games for phones and what have you.
Yeah.
And to me, this is great. If you really just bring a nice value content proposition to the table, you're going to give me, you know, for $5 as much stages as an old, you know, $7 game would have cost. I'm going to be just inclined to buy your map packs when it's like that.
Yeah.
So, well done, Nintendo. I hope you can stick with this, and I hope that you can show that free-to-play can be fair to play.
Indeed. Dragon Quest VIII is getting a re-release for the 3DS, including improvements such as an orchestral score. It'll be coming out on August 27th in Japan. That's super exciting.
Yeah, this isn't
the one that everyone's waiting for, though. It's 7 that everyone's waiting for to get a re-release, right?
Well, 7 is already out in Japan, and the reason why people, especially in North America, are super, super into the idea of 7 coming out in North America is because the PS1 port of 7 had a really lackluster translation. But unfortunately, that translation is exactly why we're unlikely to get a port of that game in North America. That game has one of the largest scripts of any video game of all time, and translating it would be a monumentally expensive endeavor. Much more expensive than Square Enix believes they would make in profits in selling such a thing.
Well, hopefully we'll get Dragon Quest VIII,
The good thing about Dragon Quest VIII is that that was a PS2 game that they brought over with a high-budget translation already. They brought voice actors on board for the first time in the series and had, like, well-done, high-class voice acting done for the game. So a lot of the translation work for this new Dragon Quest VIII is already done. I do expect it to come out over here. I do.
Wonderful.
We also have word that Nobunaga's Ambition Creation is going to be releasing in North America for the PC, PlayStation 3, and PlayStation 4. It'll be released in North America on September 1st and in Europe on September 4th.
Under the title Nobunaga's Ambition, Sphere of Influence.
Oh, excellent. The Danganronpa manga has been licensed for release in North America by Dark Horse. This is exciting, of course, because Danganronpa has a great story that is definitely worth following along with via the animation and the manga.
Yay!
PC indie hit Valdis Story, Abyssal City, which is known for being a really well-designed Metroidvania game, is getting a new patch, or I should say, recently got a new patch. The new patch includes a ton of bug fixes, as well as new weapons, new characters, and new bosses. Plus, 2 new zones to explore. So, if you're a fan of this game, which I certainly am, I would highly recommend you check it out.
In some fabulous news, the Tokyo-based studio Life Wonders is developing an English-language version of the gay dating sim Fantastic Boyfriends, Legends of Mid-Earth. They are using an Indiegogo campaign to help speed up the progress, and, you know, they're hoping that can cover the cost of testing and translating and all of that business. And I'm totally down because, you know, anything that means more gay dating sims is good in my book.
The thing to keep in mind is that Fantastic Boyfriends, in its original Japanese release, is actually a free-to-play game for iOS and Android. This, of course, has a Bara lifestyle, a Bara art style, which means, you know, the guys are hairy, big, and beefy.
Oh, I know.
You know, but, you know, some of our listeners may not be looking at pictures of these dudes. So, you know, the way that the sales for this game worked in Japan is that the core story was free to play, and you would buy expansions for, like, oh, if you want to go on a date with this cutie, you may have to, like, buy new content or whatever. And, you know, I think that that is probably a good way to sell this kind of thing, because I think a lot of people are really going to struggle with, like, what is a dating sim? Do I want to play a dating sim? Do I want to play a dating sim with furry, kind of chubby, muscle guys? For many of us, the answer is fuck yes, I do.
Well, yeah, especially the blacksmith and, like, the ogre.
But if you're on the fence, you know, you'll be able to check it out for free, more likely than not. And if you get really into it, just buy some expansions to support the developer. We will be linking you to an article that links to their Indiegogo page over at GameBuie.org.
GameBuie.org.
And in other news, Nintendo has announced Pokemon Super Mystery Dungeon for the Nintendo 3DS. This is going to be a winter release in Japan and North America, and Europe will be getting the game in early 2016. We don't know a lot about the game specifically yet, but it's going to be a Pokemon Mystery Dungeon game. That kind of tells you everything you'll need to know about whether or not you want to
We'll probably see more about it at E3.
Bandai Namco announced Super Robot Tyson BX for the Nintendo 3DS. It's going to be releasing on August 20th. and features robots from series so far announced as Night Gundam, Nadeshko, Mazinger Kaiser, Mazinger Z, some stuff from the Macross 30 game, which is actually kind of cool and interesting. Gal Geiger, which is awesome. Gorg, and with a lot more to come, as we typically see in these games.
That's great, but, you know, I did some research on this. It's actually pronounced Super Robot Tyson Biatch. The X is pronounced Och.
Are you serious? Or are you fucking with me?
I'm fucking with you, but, you know, if X can be pronounced as Key for Kingdom Hearts Key.
I hate you so much.
If you would like to fund Game Buoy Biatch, my new indie game, please head over to my Indiegogo.
Oh, damn, girl. Samurai Warriors 4 Part 2 is coming west this October. Koei Tecmo has announced that they will release the PC, PlayStation 3, PlayStation 4, and Vita versions of this game on October 2nd in Europe. No North American release date has yet been set, but one does appear to be coming. In quite closely related news, Samurai Warriors Chronicles 3 is going to be releasing on the 3DS and Vita this June in the West. That's actually not too far away. The 3DS version of the game includes bonus content based on Link and Zelda costumes from Hyrule Warriors.
Aww.
And it's going to be releasing in Europe on June 24th on both platforms. The North American release date hasn't been announced yet, but should be revealed shortly. I would expect it in the run-up to E3 news coming up.
Nice. And last but certainly not least, Koei Tecmo announced at their special Romance of the Three Kingdoms 30th anniversary event the upcoming release of Romance of the Three Kingdoms 13 for PS3, PS4, and PC. It'll be coming out in Japan on December 10th of this year. And more details will be coming over the next few months.
I don't know about you, but I'm going to wait for Romance of the Three Kingdoms 13 Lightning Returns.
Are you going to wait for Romance of the Three Kingdoms 13 2? Wait, I guess you just made the other joke.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to wait for Romance of the Three Kingdoms Biatch.
Alright, well, that's about it for our news this week, but we do have a few controversial things to talk about this week on...
Controversial.
Oh my god.
So, the first controversial thing we have to talk about this week is that Konami went to YouTube and complained about a video that was posted by George Super Bunny Hop Wideman. This was, of course, a video that was chronicling the ongoing tensions between Konami and Hideo Kojima, that included several bits of information that were supposedly given to Super Bunny Hop by privileged sources of information from inside Konami. The TLDR is, you know, that Kojima being fired is the tip of the iceberg, that a lot of people within Konami feel that Kojima has, like, a lawsuit on his hands, that, like, straight-up Kojima is being mistreated by Konami, that the office is straight-up, like, locking people outside of the building, like, punitively, if, like, literally Konami is acting like a crazy person.
Yeah.
And the way that this played out, you know, Konami complained and got YouTube to remove it. A bunch of the gaming news sites really backed Super Bunny Hop on this, and all were writing to YouTube asking for comment, and lo and behold, YouTube actually reversed the block and put the video back up, saying that Konami was in error, saying that their intellectual property was being violated by the video.
Wow.
So it's back up. You can view it again. And, you know, it's really kind of a coup that we actively saw Konami try to suppress this information. So I would definitely check this out. I definitely get yourself caught up if you're interested in the whole Konami situation.
Konami kerfuffle.
Konami kerfuffle. In other news, we also have word here. First off, okay, if you're part of a beta and you're leaking news of it, or I'm sorry, you're part of like an alpha, something that's heavily NDA'd, and you leak news of it, you're kind of a dick. That having been said, you know, we've talked here on the show about how there have been a number of video leaks regarding a potential Gears of War remake that is apparently in testing. Well, Microsoft banned all of those people by permanently disabling their Xbox Live accounts. Something that's interesting is that it also temporarily blocked all of their Xbox One privileges completely. So their Xbox One was basically entirely unusable. Like, even straight up, like, oh, I can't play play games. Something that's somewhat interesting, of course, is that Microsoft themselves have said that really that it should still be usable to play disc-based games, just not online games or downloaded games or anything that, would require like an update. Like, no, they couldn't play that, but if it's just disc-based, it'll play it. I don't know that I think that's really okay, though.
Like, shit, can't even use Netflix, or...
Yeah, no Netflix. If you own a disc copy of Destiny, you can't play it because it has to connect online. Like, even for single player, like, this is fucked. Which is why people think this is controversial. I think we all agree that if you get banned from a game service for being an absolute tool bag, that's probably fair. But to have your console be rendered unusable, even for stuff that isn't, like, playing the game that you fucked up with, that to me seems really inappropriate. I do not like it, and I feel like Microsoft is like, I love the Xbox One, why do you make choices like this? It's almost as bad as fucking ArenaNet with their Guild Wars 2 nonsense. Like, just knock it off, be a fucking professional, responsible company, and don't act like a fucking petulant child, I say as I curse left and right and rant. There was also recently a massive ban wave in World of Warcraft, specifically targeting PvP players that were using bots to sort of, fight other players most efficiently. So, that's somewhat interesting, and it's mainly controversial because the people who are botting in WoW mostly feel like, since they pay their monthly fee to play the game, that they deserve to play whether they ban or whether they bot or not. That should be a website, right? To judge whether, like, WoW players are real or not. BotOrNot.com. You were on Hot or Not, right? Slagkick?
I didn't put my picture up, but, like, I voted on Hot Guys.
You didn't vote on Hot or Not?
No, I voted. I didn't put my own picture up, though. Hell no.
Oh, boo. Obviously...
Well, I would have been, like, a total not. Hello.
Aww. Last, but certainly not least, we got a great, great, great piece here from Kotaku, which is actually where a lot of our controversial articles come from.
I'm afraid of getting that controversy.
Well, I was just going to say, I've had a lot of bad to say about Kotaku over the years, but I've also had a lot of good, as it turns out. And one of the things I appreciate about Kotaku is, due to having such an editorial focus, you do get a lot of opinion pieces that stir up a lot of controversy, and they look at a lot of topics that people are talking about and having problems with. So, and in a way, they actually do a lot for drawing attention toward things that need to have attention drawn to them. This last piece is not super, super controversial necessarily. It's just
opinion, really.
It's just sort of it's the end of a controversy. And basically, the summary here, this article is, this week, Destiny got a hell of a lot better. And the TLDR is that it's basically an article talking about how Destiny, for all of the controversy, all of the ups, all of the downs, at this point, after the release of the second major expansion, House of Wolves, came out this past Tuesday, the game is finally better than Bungie ever promised it would be. Like, the whole game, not just the House of Wolves content, but even the changes to the core game, it's now finally, like, even better than it was ever promised to be. And, it's interesting to see a major gaming site really take that position, especially after Destiny was roundly shat on by everyone on its release last year. So,
which is so weird, because even though I didn't dive in, I thought that it was a decent game.
Yeah, I love it. I thought Destiny was great, but I did appreciate a lot of the problems people had with it. It's just that, since I played the game kind of casually and when time permitted, I didn't run into the things that bothered people so much. People who were playing for hours and hours for minor upgrades, people who saw their raid gear get over to, beaten by, like, a strike drop. Like, the equivalent of, your WoW raid gear getting out-leveled by something you've gotten out of a five-man dungeon at level 91. But in the first-person shooter field, that really upset people because they're not used to that shift in stat priorities and what have you. So, and, the way progression works. In any event, all of the little quibbles have apparently now been ironed over. I've been playing House of Wolves content and loving it. There's actual story, the voice acting is much better, the script is tight and funny and interesting. I agree with Kotaku here. Destiny feels like a completely different game now, and frankly, a much better one, even though, again, I actually liked it in the first place.
Well, I may have to pick it up this summer, finally.
It's on sale this week at Toys R Us for $19.
Oh, wow. I know what we're doing tomorrow.
All right, let's do it. Unless you have anything else, Slaggy, I have a real quick aside here before we get into our discussion.
Oh?
I just wanted to go over the E3 schedule with our lovely beautiful loyal listeners out there in internet radio land. Oculus Rift is going to be holding an event on June 11th, 2015. Bethesda is going to have their E3 conference on June 14th at 6:30 p.m. Microsoft's keynote takes place June 15th at 9:30 a.m. EA's keynote is going to be on June 15th at 1 p.m. Ubisoft's keynote is going to be on June 15th at 3 p.m. Sony's keynote, which is also going to be streamed all across the internet and played in movie theaters, much like they did last year, is going to be on June 15th at 6 p.m. Nintendo's digital event is going to be on the morning of the 16th at 9 a.m., and Square Enix, who changed their time slot in an amazing game of chicken with Nintendo, is now going to be on the morning of the 16th at 10 a.m. And last but certainly not least, we have a PC gaming event that is going to be held by PC Gamer on the evening of the 16th at 5 p.m. I would expect multiple episodes of GameBuoy.org.
GameBuoy.org.
Within that window, much like we did last year. But for all of you lovely ladies and ladies and gentlemen listening to this show out there in Internet Radio Land who might want to follow along with these events as they happen, those are the times you're looking for. Anything to add, Slaggy?
GameBuoy.org.
And with that, let's get into this discussion. Well, I guess it wouldn't be a GameBuoy discussion if we weren't taking on a big topic. So, we're going to be taking on a real big one here.
Whoa!
And talking about all of the video games based on Marvel properties, basically since the early 80s. It's an inevitability we are probably going to miss a couple, especially in the early ages. But, as ever and always, if you notice we've missed something, there's something that we talked about just a little and you'd like to hear more about, tweet at us over at GameBuoy.org. The .org is spelled out D-O-T-O-R-G.
At GameBuoy.org, the .org is spelled out D-O-T-O-R-G.
Use the hashtag GameBuoyExtra and, you know, tell us what you think or what we missed.
Hashtag GameBuoyExtra.
The first Marvel-based game that I played was an Atari 2600 game made by Parker Brothers, based on Spider-Man.
Were you, like, one?
I didn't play it in 1982. My parents, you know, the thing is, I'm the youngest of three children. My parents had some video games and computer stuff before I was born.
Well, la-di-da. Flaze-da.
But yeah, so it was awful. I remember hating it. I was not really into video games when I was that young. I think I've even talked about it here on the show that my transformative moment was really with Kung Fu by Irem. There was a licensed version released by Nintendo on the NES in the early days. Anyway, though, that's neither here nor there. This Spider-Man game was effing awful. I wouldn't necessarily call it much better than the E.T. game that caused the market crash.
Ooh.
Yeah. But, you know, on the IBM PC side, like I said, things were much better. You had a lot of, like, graphic adventure games, which were really cool. A lot of, you know, almost like LucasArts style games. They were based on, you know, various Marvel franchises, including X-Men, Spider-Man. Like, there was some neat stuff going on. Unfortunately, due to my age and the fact that I didn't have, you know, like a decent PC back then. I did have a Commodore 64, but I never saw any of these games for Commodore 64, unfortunately. Though, supposedly, the X-Men game Madness and Murder World did have a C64 port. I never saw it. But supposedly these were good games. For us, though, really, this conversation starts in the arcade. Obviously, chronologically, you know, there were some NES games and we are going to get to them, but I really think that the meat and potatoes of this discussion, the thing that most of you out there are familiar with, and the things that I think Slagkick here could also talk about, really, are the arcade games, starting with 1991's Captain America and the Avengers by Data East. Slaggy, do you remember this one?
No, I didn't have a really big arcade near me, so You know, that combined with me really not knowing a lot about Marvel Comics quite at that age meant I missed out on that one.
Captain America and the Avengers was great. It had, like, it was a four-player fighting game, you know, like a beat-em-up, similar to, you know, other beat-em-ups that we've talked about. You're on the show a lot lately, it feels like. You know, things like Streets of Rage, X-Men, that sort of thing. But this one was an Avengers game. The characters you could be were Captain America, Iron Man, Hawkeye, and The Vision.
Oh.
Yeah. It got ports for the NES, Super NES, Mega Drive / Genesis, Sega Game Gear, and Game Boy. It was a really well-loved game. It had some really cute, like, voice clips in it. And it was overall actually, like, a really well-balanced, well-designed game. Especially, you know, most arcade games have sort of the reputation of being just, like, token takers. Like, this was actually a fairly well-balanced and designed game. Had fights against, you know, Red Skull. For some reason, you fought a Sentinel in one level. There was a really great Mandarin boss fight that I really recall. You know, the Ten Rings of the Mandarin, not Trevor Slattery being an actor. So, yeah, I mean, it was actually really cool. And on a closely related note, also in 1991, Sega released a somewhat lesser-known arcade game called Spider-Man the Video Game. Spider-Man the Video Game was really cool because it was also a four-player beat-em-up, but it used a lot of really cool tech things, including, like, some sprite rotation tech, similar to what you would see on, like, the Super Nintendo Mode 7 style effects.
Oh, wow.
To do, like, character warping effects. The player characters were really cool, too. It included stuff like Black Cat and, like, Namor the Submariner along with Spidey. It was really cool. You know, it had fights with Venom, Green Goblin, everyone you would expect. And the next one I want to mention, and then I'm going to tie these three games together, was 1992's X-Men.
Yes!
This is a super, super, super well-loved game. We talked about it just last week.
With the delisting.
Exactly. Got ports to PlayStation Network for PS3 and Xbox Live Arcade for Xbox 360. It also had an iOS and Android port. This was notable. In 1992, it was based on the short-lived X-Men animated pilot called Pride of the X-Men, and it was a very rare six-player arcade game using a two-screen setup. So, you know, it was a really, like, important, huge game at the time. That was the kind of game that, like, all of your friends would be like, oh, it's a new arcade? Well, if they don't have an X-Men cabinet, I don't want to go there. And it's funny because, you know, between Captain America and the Avengers, Spider-Man the video game, and X-Men the arcade game, really, for a period of time in the arcade, all of the best beat-em-ups were Marvel-licensed titles. And it's funny because we actually see that same kind of domination come into play in the second half of the 1990s, where all of the best fighting games were Marvel-licensed games.
Right.
And that actually got its start with 1993's release, The Punisher, which was a Capcom game. It was not, however, a fighting game. This was actually a beat-em-up, and it's kind of the transition for Capcom from beat-em-up to fighting game.
Oh, huh.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, at that time, they were so busy with Street Fighter that, you know, I'm sure that they really weren't thinking about, oh, how can we make more fighting games, except that's all they do now.
Pretty much. You know, so the Punisher game, it was cool. Like, it did get a Mega Drive port, though I don't know that it released in North America, unfortunately. It was a really cool game, very basic beat-em-up, a lot in common with Final Fight. And, you know, I was talking a few weeks ago about how you can sort of see a progression in the design of Capcom's beat-em-ups. The Punisher is sort of the puzzle piece that goes between, like, Final Fight and, like, Alien vs. Predator or Cadillacs and Dinosaurs or something like that. Cadillacs and Dinosaurs being a comic, but not a Marvel comic. I should probably move
on. Sounds like a Kesha album title.
Right? It basically is. She's sung songs about both of those things. You know, we come to 1994's release, X-Men: Children of the Atom. And this, in a lot of ways, was probably the biggest game in Marvel's video game history, up to this point, 1994. This was an arcade release. It did get ports to Sega Saturn, PC, and PlayStation. And it was the two-player fighting game that Capcom did based on X-Men, you know, the X-Men animated series, basically. Playable characters were stuff like Wolverine, Cyclops, Storm, Psylocke. For some reason, Silver Samurai was in there, and Spiral, and, you know, they always have a couple of off-the-wall choices. But really, this was the game that I really felt like this was where the Marvel foothold in the arcades really happened.
Yeah, it's just unfortunate that Dazzler didn't make a return.
Yeah, well, I'm pouring one out for Dazzler, I tell you what. She's had a rough year. But basically, you know, it's a super well-designed 2D fighting game. It brought a lot of new ideas to Capcom's 2D fighting game space. It had super meters with super moves. It was the first one to have super jumps where, you know, you tap down and then tap up and you jump up like multiple screen heights. It was the first of their 2D fighting games that had like really interactive backgrounds, which actually they don't really do a whole lot of, though they are going back to that now with Street Fighter V. You know, X-Men Children of the Atom had things such as like in the Mojoverse, there was one level that had like a glass floor. And if you had enough people, like, falling hard on the floor, or Iceman had an attack that would summon a giant snowball that would fall to the ground, if you did, like, moves like that enough, the glass would actually break, and you'd fall down several screens, you'd still be fighting while falling, and then land on another plane and start fighting there. So, you know, there was really some real inventiveness and really some real experimentation in the design of this game that really hooked people in the arcades, and it became very popular. As you're about to hear, you know, this series of games that stemmed from X-Men Children of the Atom basically became like an annualized sequel fest, culminating, of course, in the year 2000's Marvel vs. Capcom 2 New Age of Heroes, which was the apex of Marvel in the arcade space. But backing up just a little bit, we have another title by Data East, once again leveraging their license of the Avengers property. This one was Avengers in Galactic Storm in 1995. This was an awful game. It had such things as, like, Ponytail Thor, all kinds of characters from, like, a very weird mid-90s era of Marvel continuity, where basically everything was, like, grim, gritty, and extreme! It's actually, like, a real shit show. I must confess, I've only ever played the game on MAME. Maybe if I found a real arcade cabinet of it, I'd like it more. But as it stands, it just was an ugly, gross mess. It had, like, rather than being hand-drawn sprites or polygons, it was, like, Donkey Kong Country-style, like, 3D renders. But unlike Donkey Kong Country or even Killer Instinct, which also famously went that route for its graphics, everything in Avengers and Galactic Storm looks very low res, lots of sharp lines with very little anti-aliasing. It was just a mess. It was super gross and played really sluggishly and unpleasantly.
That sucks.
Yeah, it's kind of a shit show. So that still just kind of, you know, is what it is though. And luckily we moved on from there to Marvel Super Heroes, which is another Capcom 2D fighting game. This was obviously an arcade release. It got ports to the Sega Saturn and the Sony PlayStation. This took the basic game design of X-Men Children of the Atom and brought it all across the Marvel Universe. So while we lost playable characters like, I was gonna say Psylocke, but she might have been in that, we did gain, you know, Captain America, Spider-Man, Iron Man, Thanos, Blackheart for some reason, you know, the son of Mephisto. So, it was a really cool game. It had a really cool mechanic where, the Infinity Gems were in play, which, you know, obviously are sort of a big part of the Marvel U right now.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone's all about them since the movies, it turns out, are gonna be all about them. And you could basically get any of the gems during a fight and had a button command. It was typically, I wanna say, half circle front to back and three punches, but I could be wrong. That would activate the gem you had, and they would actually give you, like, special effects in fight. And if you're using a character that has an affinity for a specific gem, you would actually get, like, a special bonus. So, like, if Spider-Man had, I think it was, like, reality or speed, one of the two, like, there would actually be, like, a second clone Spider-Man on screen that you would have, like, two Spider-Mans hitting one dude and doing double damage for it, so your combos were hitting for way more damage.
Nice.
That was just a really cool concept. They kind of revisited that with the Pandora gems in the Street Fighter vs. Tekken game that Capcom did a couple years back. But again, you know, there was a lot of experimentation, more of the sort of interactive backgrounds, including, I think this one had a bridge that would break under you, similar to the Mojoverse stage. stage in X-Men Children of the Atom, fall several screens, land on a new plane, and keep fighting. But overall, you know, these games were super well-received, and so it was only a half-surprise in 1996 when Capcom released X-Men vs. Street Fighter. This was, of course, a big deal because it's an effing crossover. Like, you didn't necessarily see a lot of that at this in that day and age. And in fact, I mean, really, you kind of still don't. Like, if you really stop and think about it, Marvel vs. Capcom is pretty special. But X-Men vs. Street Fighter brought back several characters from X-Men Children of the Atom, pitted them against a roster from Street Fighter, based on the Street Fighter Alpha sub-franchise of Street Fighter, and basically brought over-the-top fighting action to Street Fighter for the first time. You know, screen-clearing, like, giant laser Hadoukens and what have you.
Yeah.
Shinku Hadouken. That really originated in that X-Men vs. Street Fighter game. This did have somewhat competent ports for the PlayStation, and an amazing arcade-perfect port for the Sega Saturn using the Sega Saturn RAM expansion card. In 1997, second verse, same as the first, we got Marvel Super Heroes vs. Street Fighter, which, as you may expect, was basically the same concept, but rather than being a mashup of Street Fighter Alpha and X-Men Children of the Atom, it was a mashup of Street Fighter Alpha and Marvel Super Heroes. Somewhat interestingly, this game was actually, like, quite well-loved in its day. It's just really unfortunate that it, again, especially in North America, only had that shitty PlayStation port for home play. Though, again, there was an arcade perfect port for Sega Saturn in Japan. Luckily, everything changed in 1999, skipped a year there, with the release of Marvel vs. Capcom Clash of Superheroes. Got an arcade perfect port on the Dreamcast. You know, we wouldn't see the Marvel vs. Capcom series running on actual home hardware until Marvel vs. Capcom 2, but Marvel vs. Capcom 1 at least was an extremely perfect port to the Sega Dreamcast. And that one did get released in every part of the world. You know, basically, they took all of the Marvel characters from Marvel Superheroes, well, not all of them, but characters from all of Marvel Superheroes, and characters from all of Capcom's history, including many characters who had become forgotten by this point. Characters like Strider Hiryu came back at this point.
Oh, yeah.
Captain Commando himself came back at this point. And Capcom actually saw, like, a revitalization of several of these characters due to this game.
Too bad that didn't happen with MVC3.
So, you know, this game was a really big deal, did very well in arcades. People really loved it. Lots of people played it for a long time. But 2000 saw the release of Marvel vs. Capcom 2 New Age of Heroes, which famously had something like 54 playable characters. Most of these games we've talked about, you know, we haven't talked about the specific number of playable characters they had, but most of them were like 8 to 20.
Mm-hmm.
So this one went all the way up to like 54 and had basically every character that had ever been in a Street Fighter Alpha or a Marvel Super Heroes or / X-Men game, and a bunch of new ones. And, you know, this game, it was famous for being so unbalanced that it actually was almost like a subversive form of balancing. Like, this game is so broken that you can basically break it with anyone, and so it still feels balanced in competitive play.
It's so weird, though, because everyone loves MVC2, right?
Well, but that's exactly why, because despite it being a complete clusterfuck broken mess, it is so broken that you can't really pick a character or combo team that doesn't have some way to win.
Oh.
And something that I did hesitate to mention is that, you know, these games, the Versus games, took on a tag team system where you would pick two or three characters rather than the genre typical one character and, you know, go one-on-one fighting, where with the Versus series you would pick two characters or, you know, three in MVC2, make a little team, and when one character died, rather than going to round two, you would just pull out your next character. And for strategic purposes, you could on the fly swap out characters, almost like a tag team in wrestling.
Yeah.
And this actually brought on like a whole wave of tag team fighters. It practically spawned a genre unto itself, which when you consider it was just a licensed game is actually really funny. Licensed games have a real accepted truth in a lot of ways that licensed games are going to be shit. But the reason I wanted to talk about Marvel games is there are actually quite a few Marvel games that are really great.
Yeah, a lot of them are quite a blast.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, some of these games, like we're talking about here with these fighting games, were actually, like, integral pillars of the development of fighting games. So, you know, unfortunately, though, with Marvel vs. Capcom 2 New Age of Heroes in the year 2000, that sort of saw the end of Marvel in the arcades in a lot of ways. So, I want to go back now and start talking about the 8-bit and 16-bit years for Marvel games before we catch back up with what happened after that year 2000 there. So, Slaggy, have you played any of these NES games?
Well, I mean, after the shitty X-Men game, I was just like, no, so...
You know, I can't really blame you for that. You know, the X-Men game for the NES, Uncanny X-Men, it was released by LJN in 1989. I think I may have talked about it in our Kusoge episode. I have, like, a strange like for it, but I recognize it's probably...
You like terrible things, that's why we're friends.
Well, it's probably one of the worst games I've ever played. It is a basically completely broken top-down game. You could almost call it a Zelda-alike, except it's linear, stage-based.
How dare
and
you?
It's actually like an insult to Zelda to mention them in the same sentence. And I'm not a big Zelda fan, but no, that X-Men game is fucking awful. It was followed shortly thereafter by a Silver Surfer game. Silver Surfer is kind of weird. We don't think about it a lot now, but for a brief moment in time, like, there was, like, a Silver Surfer cartoon and stuff. And so they made what was essentially a top-down shmup. I believe it also had side-scrolling sections, starring the Silver Surfer. Unfortunately, it was also poorly designed. Like, the bullet, like, your hitboxes were really bad. Your character moved really slow. It was just not a fun game. Unfortunately, that also applies to the 1990 LJN release, The Punisher. Sort of seeing a theme here. LJN produced a lot of crap.
Yeah, LJN had a lot of shitty games, didn't they?
They really did.
I mean, because they did the Friday the 13th and Nightmare on Elm Street games, didn't they?
They did.
Oh, God.
And,
LJN.
You know, they brought the shit to Game Boy in 1990 with The Amazing Spider-Man. Fortunately, things on the 8-bit platforms take a little bit of a turn for the better after that. Amazing Spider-Man is sloppy, but as a Game Boy game, you can kind of put up with it. And then they released Wolverine in 1991, and this LJN NES Wolverine game is actually not completely awful. It's not a good game, necessarily, but it's not awful. It featured Wolverine and had cameos from characters from all across sort of the X-universe. It was a side-scrolling platform game. It still had, you know, a lot of, like, cheap hits, a lot of awful designed levels and enemies, but overall, it was a step in the right direction, which was followed on that platform with the last LJN NES game, Spider-Man Return of the Sinister Six. And this is notable for actually being a fairly decent Spider-Man game. As you probably guessed from the title, it was about Spider-Man fighting the Sinister Six. It was a side-scrolling game. Spider-Man had his trademark abilities. And, you know, I actually always felt like the game felt like a shitty wannabe clone of a game made by Sega in 1990. And I expect this is probably true, because Sega released in 1990 for the Genesis a game called The Amazing Spider-Man, which was also released on Sega CD as an upgraded port called Amazing Spider-Man vs. the Kingpin. And this was noteworthy. It was a side-scrolling game with really great graphics designed to be fucking balls hard, which I'm actually super into balls hard stuff.
Oh, I know.
And, you know, it was like a well-designed game. Spider-Man had all of the Spider-Man abilities you'd want. Climbing stuff, webbing stuff, swinging from webs. The level design was mostly pretty good. It's actually a game that I would say to this day is worth playing. You know, big, well-animated sprites for the time and everything. And it really felt to me like a precursor to, again, you know, that 1993-1994 era where really Marvel games blew up. And it's funny, because just like in the arcade, Marvel games blew up because of the X-Men. And if you disagree with
me, X-Men was really huge in the early 90s. That was their wheelhouse, really. I mean, unless I'm totally wrong.
No, you're absolutely 100% right.
I mean, I'm speaking from the perspective of being like an 8-year-old kid, but I remember seeing, like, X-Men, and, like, you know, not really seeing a lot of other stuff out there for other franchises.
Were you really 8 in 93, 94?
Well, 93, 94, I would have been, like, 9, 10.
Okay. Jesus, that makes me feel old. But, all right. Even though, really, I'm only a couple of years older than you. Anyway, you know, this like X-Men eight. Game for the Mega Drive / Genesis was a home run. Beautiful graphics, really well represented the X-Men's individual powers. You know, I've joked here on the show throughout the last several years about how the X-Men's powers were represented in the X-Men arcade game. We had Wolverine, like, clanging his claws together to create a laser. Colossus apparently changing from human form to metal form so fast that he creates an explosion. Like, these things are silly. And the 1993 Sega Genesis Sega-designed X-Men game got their powers exactly right. Aside from the fact that you did have a power meter, but, you know, that was game design at the time. But if you were Gambit, you know, you had cards that you could charge and throw.
Well, I would hope so.
Wolverine's power was to pull out his claws. Cyclops had his eye lasers, and everything was just really well represented, true to the show, and to the comic. But ultimately, in this era, Slaggy was right. X-Men stuff in this era was being based more on the show than the comics. And I don't think that's an entirely bad thing.
Yeah.
The thing that I really remember, and it was something I loved about the design of the game, is that each little level was sort of almost like a little bit more open than you would typically see in platformers of the era. They all encouraged a little bit more exploration. And as a result, Nightcrawler could fuck the level design completely. Because you could do things like teleport through walls that you were supposed to go through whole labyrinths to, like, find keys to open doors and hit levers for. But if you had Nightcrawler, you could just teleport through it and, in some cases, end entire levels in seconds that would normally take, you know, an hour or two to explore and go through. But, you know, as silly as it seems, I actually felt like that was good game design in that's really how that power should work. Nightcrawler's power shouldn't just be like the X-Men arcade game where he runs around the screen really fast while glowing. Like, that's not what Nightcrawler does. Of course, in 1994, because this was the mid-90s and a good game is always going to get a sequel, Sega released X-Men 2 The Clone Wars. This was, again, you know, another hit game. Had a huge, huge following and response. Unfortunately, it is the end of that series of games, but only because Sega wasn't able to get a third game developed fast enough. They did try. X-Men 2 The Clone Wars followed in the footsteps of the first game, but also added a playable character in the form of Magneto, which was quite a big deal to nerds at the time. Also in 1994, we saw Acclaim get some of the action and jump in with Wolverine Adamantium Rage, which, amusingly, while being a Sega Genesis and Super Nintendo game, I would say is significantly worse designed than LJN's 1991 Wolverine NES game. They did kind of get it right in trying to incorporate Wolverine's healing factor into a video game for the first time. You could idle, and slowly Wolverine would regain health, but unfortunately, the game design was really unforgiving. The sprites were, you know, not super well animated. There was a lot of, like, really cheap hits from enemies. All of the enemies were, like, damage sponges. It was just unfun to play. It was not a well-designed game, unfortunately. Alternatively, though, US Gold, for possibly the only time in the time that they were releasing games, put out a fairly good Incredible Hulk game for the Super NES, Sega Genesis, Sega Master System, and Sega Game Gear. It was a 2D platformer that used, like, a rage mechanic, and the more angry Hulk got, the more powerful he was, which is appropriate.
Yeah.
There was also the fairly famous 1994 SNES release by LJN, also for Sega Genesis, of Spider-Man and Venom Maximum Carnage. This was a one player, but you could select one of two characters, a side-scrolling beat-em-up based on the Maximum Carnage saga that was quite a big deal among comic book fans back in the day. This is kind of interesting because the game got two pseudo-sequels, and I don't think the same people developed any of these games. One of them was, of course, Spider-Man the Animated Series, released in 1995, and the other was Venom and Spider-Man in Separation Anxiety. Both of these other games were also games that were for multiple platforms, Super Nintendo and Genesis, but these other two were published by Acclaim, rather than LJN. And, you know, all in all, Venom Spider-Man Separation Anxiety is two players. I played it recently with whatever Xander wanted to be called on this show. He had a lot of fans. He was like a dead pirate king or something. I don't really know.
Yeah. Oh, I thought you were just going to say your boo thing.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't call him my boo thing because that's not how I talk, but it's probably technically a true statement. Yeah, but I mean, we played it on one of our early dates, and you know, it's all right. You can probably tell by the way my voice went that high-pitched, it's not really
that you're going
that
through
right.
The changes of life right now?
All right. I have a demon inside me.
Well,
you know, the game
true.
Is, it's not super good. Most of these Spider-Man side-scrolling beat-em-ups are relics of their time. I don't think I could honestly recommend anyone go hunt down a cartridge of Maximum Carnage or Spider-Man Animated Series or Separation Anxiety. I would definitely recommend, if you're listening to this show looking for, like, what's classic that is still worth playing, because, you know, that's sort of the perspective that we do these episodes from, is to talk about, like, what games are still cool, what games
were
not worth
looking into. Well, you know, something that was notable about Venom and Spider-Man's Separation Anxiety is that, you know, Spider-Man would leave Venom at home, and then Venom would just, like, be barking all day, wreaking havoc around the house, you know, biting the furniture, you know, urinating all over the place, knocking over his food bowl.
Stop. Is that, you know, most of these games we've talked about, Spider-Man, Amazing Spider-Man versus Kingpin, the two Sega developed X-Men games, the Incredible Hulk game, like, those are all worth playing. They're all worth looking into. If you're at your local retro shop and you see a copy of these games for, like, $10 or under, you'd be foolish not to pick them up. Unfortunately, Maximum Carnage, Spider-Man Animated Series, Separation Anxiety, probably better left to your memories unless you have an appreciation for Kusoge. Which, to be fair, you might like shit games. I certainly do. More power to ya. However, also in 1995, Capcom released the first of two criminally underappreciated Marvel games for the Super Nintendo. And only the Super Nintendo. The first was X-Men Mutant Apocalypse, and it's sort of loosely based on their fighting game X-Men Children of the Atom. But rather than being a 2D fighting game, it's a 2D side-scrolling action platformer.
Oh, that sounds great.
And you can pick any number of X-Men, there's like five or six of them that you can pick, to do all of your cool platforming and exploring, but your X-Men do have mutant powers and abilities that are activated by doing fighting game style commands. So for, you know, Wolverine to do like his Berserker Barrage from the X-Men arcade, you would do the same motion as Berserker Barrage, and it would come out. And so it really felt like an add-on to what Capcom was doing
it's
in the arcade
almost like Subspace
sphere.
Emissary, but like pre-Subspace Emissary.
In some ways. I mean, it's certainly like a downport, like a downgraded version of the game, but still really cool, definitely worth looking into. The other one was Marvel Super Heroes War of the Gems, which came out in 1996 for Super Nintendo. And, you
was
know,
it truly outrageous?
Not that kind of gem. These were the Infinity Gems. Which, you know, like I was saying, that Marvel Super Heroes, the arcade game focused on the Infinity Gems saga, had cool, you know, use of the gems in the game. We saw that with Marvel Super Heroes War of the Gems too. And in fact, very similar to the Marvel Super Heroes and X-Men Children of the Atom connection, where both games use the same basic engine. That was true about Mutant Apocalypse and War of the Gems as well. It was just like they took Mutant Apocalypse, swapped out a few of the mutants for other Marvel superheroes, and made a new game out of it. These are both hell of but worth looking into. Unfortunately, a game not worth looking into, if you could find a real copy of it. I've unfortunately never seen or even heard of a real copy being seen local to me. But Sega did make another Spider-Man game. This one was Spider-Man Web of Fire for the 32X in 1996. I played an emulated copy of it, and I don't know if, like, maybe the game wasn't finished or the emulator I was using was jank, but it was, like, a messy, buggy, broken piece of shit.
Isn't that kind of true of everything for the 32X, though?
Well, and that's the thing, is I had a 32X, and yeah, all of the games were garbage. So I kind of feel like that might just be a 32X thing and not a Spider-Man Web of Fire thing. But sorry, Spider-Man Web of Fire, you're a 32X game and you're shit. So around that time, we got another somewhat interesting release. This time for the PS1 Saturn, because we're now transitioning away from the 16-bit era, and we're talking about the 1996 release, Iron Man and Exo Manowar in Heavy Metal.
What?
This released on the PlayStation, Sega Saturn, Game Boy, Game Gear, and DOS platforms, LOL. And, you know, it's funny that, you know, we think of Iron Man now as, like, a world-class license. Like, fucking Iron Man, that's, like, a world-class IP. It's
RDJ.
Yeah, it's fucking Iron Man. And, well, in 1996, he was only really high enough profile to slum it in crossover games made by Acclaim featuring Exo Manowar.
Who's Exo Manowar?
He was like some nonsense Valiant Comics character or something. But the game itself was actually not awful. I mean, it was like a fairly basic 2D combat-based 2D platformer. But, you know, it was actually not a terribly designed game. It was kind of basic, but I had the DOS version, actually, and, you know, it actually had really high production values for a DOS game at the time. I feel like you didn't see a lot of 2D platformers in that space. There was also The Incredible Hulk The Pantheon Saga in 1996 for PlayStation and Sega Saturn and MS-DOS. I played this, but it was, you know, sort of in a really weird time in my life. I didn't get a lot out of it, unfortunately. And that also, sadly, goes for the 1997 Fantastic Four game for PlayStation. That one was done by Acclaim, and both of these games were, to me, sort of notable just for being, like, shovelware crap. Like, in the mid to late 90s, Marvel had a period where they signed a lot of really unfavorable contracts because they were effectively going bankrupt. And when I look at some of these shitty games, and certainly, you know, that's how some of the shittier Marvel movies got made, were from decisions made in that time period. But, you know, it's just like there were just these really shitty games that did not appear to have any quality control from Marvel. And that unfortunately continued with the 2000 release of Blade for the Game Boy Color and PlayStation as well. Things finally started to sort of get a little better when Activision created the X-Men Mutant Academy fighting game for PlayStation and Game Boy Color. This was a 3D-based 2D fighting game. You know, it moved sluggishly, and it was kind of, you know, not like a great game, but it was at least better than The Incredible Hulk and The Fantastic Four. Then there was a fairly well-liked Activision Spider-Man game that was sort of the start of Spider-Man games being good. Because you think about it now, and, you know, there's actually been quite a few good Spider-Man games. That sort of started with the 2000 release of the Activision Spider-Man game on PlayStation, Nintendo 64,
didn't that coincide
Dreamcast,
with the,
PC, Macintosh, and Game Boy Color.
Didn't that kind of coincide with the movie tie-in? Or was that a little earlier than that?
I thought it was a little earlier than that, but it could have been. You know, I'm thinking about it now, like, it could have been.
Because you're really getting to, you know, not, this isn't Marvel buoy, you know, in terms of, like, comics in the larger franchise, but you really start to think about it, and this is really where we started to see a bunch of Marvel movies come up, was in this kind of turn of the century.
Yeah, yeah, and you know, the first Spider-Man movie came out in 2002, so this was a little before that. But, you know, we did see that sort of represented in games to some degree.
And wasn't that around the time that, you know,
yeah, there was.
Like, speaking of Blade, they were trying to make Blade a thing, so it seems like their choices of who were represented in games were kind of like who they were trying to, you know, push. Or would you say that's always kind of been true?
Well, I think, you know, again, we were tying the X-Men to how big the X-Men animated series was and how X-Men was really popping up in pop culture. So I think you're right, you know, they did do a Blade game, they did a Fantastic Four game, they did the X-Men Mutant Academy game and the Spider-Man game. And, you know, X-Men, Fantastic Four, Blade, and Spider-Man all had movies within a few years of these games. And in fact, in the year 2002, well, hold on, X-Men had Mutant Academy got a sequel in 2001 solely for the PlayStation console. This one, as a game, was actually a lot better. If you were gonna play X-Men Mutant Academy or Mutant Academy 2, I would recommend Mutant Academy 2. It can't be a very expensive game, because I used to see copies of it all over the place. Something interesting about it is that it had a guest cameo from Spider-Man as a playable character.
Oh, hey, Peter.
Which ties into, you know, in 2002, we did see movie-related games for Blade 2 and Spider-Man movie. This Spider-Man game was based on the movie starring Tobey Maguire. Blade was obviously based on the Blade movie starring Wesley Snipes. Spider-Man was released on the PC, GameCube, PlayStation 2, Xbox, and Game Boy Advance. And Blade 2 was released for the PlayStation 2 and Xbox. Spider-Man was in a lot of ways just like a movie-themed version of the Activision game that we were just talking about. Like, so much to the point that, I mean, they're basically just, they have different stories, but, like, the engine and stuff is practically identical. Blade 2 was not a great game, but, you know, just, like, stereotypical for the time 3D action game. game, unfortunately. But that does, of course, bring us to the 2002 release of X-Men Next Dimension, which was a PlayStation 2, Xbox, and GameCube game that was sort of meant to be like a new and improved version of X-Men Mutant Academy, but with a lot more focus on, like, X-Men the movie, like, costumes and stuff. Unfortunately, it was
Wolverine
a shit game.
Being 6 feet tall and stuff.
Yeah, right? He's not 5'3 anymore. Who cares about that? Hugh Jackman's 6 foot tall. But there was also a Hulk game for GameCube, PlayStation 2, Xbox, and Windows released by Vivendi that was...
Oh, Vivendi!
Really well received. It had, like, destructible environments and stuff. It was actually, like, a really cool game.
You mean Hulk smashable environments?
Yeah, they were Hulk smashable environments. 2004 brought with it the Spider-Man 2 movie adaptation, which is basically the previous Spider-Man game, but with a little more on top. This is actually, like, regarded as, like, the second best Spider-Man game. Spider-Man 2 for the GameCube, Xbox, PC, and even got a Mac port. Also for PlayStation 2, PlayStation Portable, Game Boy Advance, Nintendo DS, and N-Gage.
N-Gage, man.
The portable versions are a scaled-down, different game design. Let's be clear.
Welcome to everything ever.
Right? But things get really interesting at this point with the 2004 release of X-Men Legends. X-Men Legends was released for the PlayStation 2, GameCube, Xbox, and N-Gage, and it is basically a X-Men-style take on almost like the Diablo formula. It is the precursor to the Marvel Ultimate Alliance games. And this is a really well-loved game. You know, they're basically action RPGs. They have stat systems, skill trees, usually four-player co-op. And X-Men Legends and X-Men Legends 2 Rise of Apocalypse, which came out a year later in 2005, these were games that had a very rabid fan base. The ones that had, like, PC ports, like, people would be, like, making their own characters for these games. Just, like, a lot, like, really well-loved games. Super good, too. If you have the chance to play X-Men Legends, you find a copy at a store and it's cheap or, you know, it's affordable, get it.
Yeah.
Like, get it. These are great games, a lot of fun, tons of Easter eggs. If you're a, you know, true believer Marvel fan, absolutely super highly recommended. For Spider-Man fans, what is generally considered the best Spider-Man game, released in 2005. This was for the GameCube, PlayStation 2, Windows, Xbox, Game Boy Advance, Nintendo DS, and mobile phone platforms. I'm obviously not talking about the Game Boy Advance, DS, or mobile phone versions of Ultimate Spider-Man. Ultimate Spider-Man was a cel-shaded open-world game based around, you know, Ultimate Spider-Man. Not Miles Morales yet. He didn't exist yet. It was still just, like, Teen Peter. But it was just really well done. It wasn't tied to, like, any specific multimedia event other than just being an Ultimate Spider-Man promo. And that allowed it to really explore a lot of characters and villains that aren't normally represented in games. It had, you know, alternate costumes and stuff, a lot of things that people expect from Spider-Man games now. It was just, like, a really well-designed, well-thought-out, fun-to-play game. If you are looking for a Spider-Man game, you've never played one, and you are looking on the GameCube, PlayStation 2, Windows, or Xbox platforms, Ultimate Spider-Man is the way to go. It is the best.
Around!
On the complete flip side of that is the other 2005, big 2005 Marvel release. This was by Electronic Arts. It is a fighting game based on the Marvel Universe called Marvel Nemesis Rise of the Imperfects. It was made for the GameCube, PS2, PSP, DS, and Xbox. And, you know, when Electronic Arts got the rights to do games based on the Marvel Universe, they clearly thought they were going to come for Capcom and do a fighting game, a crossover fighting game. Unfortunately, EA doesn't have a lot of properties that are super marketable next to Marvel. Because what is EA but, like, sports games primarily? So what they did is they worked with Marvel to create a set of new characters to fight against the Marvel characters. These were called the Imperfects. The problem is they were all really poorly designed, not well thought out, and were all meant to be like, oh, this is like the antithesis of Wolverine. This is the antithesis of Cyclops. This is the antithesis of Spider-Man. And as a result, they're all just like these really super Mary Sue characters just awful. The game itself was, like, really sloppy 3D fighting. It is just, it is a complete mess. It is worth it if you're into Kusoge. It is super awful. It's a bad game. It is a bad game.
It's a bad game.
It's a bad game. But, you know, it's worth noting this moment in history. And, you know, quite a few people, because there was not, like, Marvel fighting games up until Marvel got the rights back to make Marvel vs. Capcom 3. A lot of people think that Marvel Nemesis Rise of the Imperfects must have left a pretty bad taste in Marvel's mouth. Because it is a shit show. We already talked briefly about the X-Men Legends 2 Rise of the Apocalypse, which also came out in 2005, on the similar platforms to the first, PlayStation 2, GameCube, Xbox, N-Gauge, PSP, PC.
That's tickling me, the N-Gauge.
Well, you know, for a brief moment in time, the N-Gauge did exist.
Yep.
So I'm going to go to, that was basically like an expanded version of the first X-Men Legends. Again, just a really great game, tons of fun, lots of lore and Easter eggs, and just good times for Marvel fans. I highly recommend checking it out if you're interested in that kind of game, especially if you play on the PC, because there are, like, hundreds of, like, fan-made character packs to, like, bring in characters that were never designed for the game, but that actually are really well-balanced and fun to play as if they were real, authentic characters. It's really amazing what the mod community has done with X-Men Legends 2, honestly. The next real big game to talk about, though, is The Incredible Hulk Ultimate Destruction for PlayStation 2, Xbox, GameCube. This game followed in the footsteps of the 2003 Hulk game, and is another one that is really worth looking into. It really built on, like, the destructible environment stuff, which is why it's called Ultimate Destruction. And it's actually, like, a lot of fun to play. We also, in 2005, got a Punisher third-person shooter action game by THQ for the PlayStation 2, Xbox, Windows, and mobile phone platforms. It wasn't amazing, but it was, you know, as those kinds of games go, it wasn't bad. I mean, the problem I have with some of these Marvel games is, like, these are bad games, but I like the licenses so much that I really struggle with, like, being properly critical of them. One game where I don't have that problem is with the Fantastic Four movie game. This was for the PlayStation 2, Xbox, Nintendo GameCube, Windows, and Game Boy Advance platforms in 2005 also. And it was a shit show. Like, they tried really hard to make a good game, and that's
cool. Did
they
have Johnny Storm in just a towel?
Did they have Johnny Storm what?
Wearing just a towel, like in the movie?
Oh, Chris Evans in his towel with his little chest hairs poking up. Yeah, unfortunately, they did not. They tried to make it a Fantastic Four movie game set in a universe based a little bit more on the Marvel universe. You know, you fight the Mole Men and everything, but it didn't work. It was not a well-designed game. It played like crap. There was also Spider-Man Battle for New York. And this was for the Game Boy Advance and Nintendo DS platforms.
Interesting.
And it was bad. I hate to just say that a game is bad, as y'all know, but it's bad. It was a 2D platforming game loosely based within the Ultimate Spider-Man universe. Spider-Man and the Green Goblin as playable characters, which could potentially be neat, but unfortunately, it's just a really poorly designed game. It is just not fun. Luckily, there are some really fun Spider-Man games coming out, so, you know, I mean, stay tuned. But the last for this sort of era, as it were, that I want to talk about is the 2007 PlayStation 2, PlayStation Portable, and Game Boy Advance release of Ghost Rider. And this, despite being loosely based on the awful Ghost Rider movie, is actually like a fairly competent Devil May Cry clone.
Really?
Or like a Gears of, or not Gears of War, but God of War, like that style of character action. It's actually like a not a bad game. Like, it's definitely one that I would describe as underappreciated.
Wow.
Yeah, right? That's super weird, because most people don't even know it exists, but it was published by 2K Games. If you find a copy of it, I would actually recommend looking into it. It's not bad at all. Moving into the era of the PlayStation 3, Xbox 360, and Wii, we were getting games like X-Men, the official game.
None of the other ones are official.
right? Like, this one's literally called The Official Game. It was not super good. Unfortunately, you know, it's kind of a running theme. It was based, unfortunately, on X-Men 3. You know, X-Men The Last Stand. And, yeah.
X-Men The Now Retconned.
Right? Like, this movie doesn't even exist anymore. Does that mean the game doesn't? Something that was kind of cool is that Chris Claremont, who is one of, like, the biggest writers in comics of all time for the X-Men, actually wrote the story for the game. And the story was actually, like, a lot better than the movie. Unfortunately, the game itself did not play super well. It is worth mentioning that the Game Boy Advance version is a completely different 2D platformy game that was designed by WayForward. And
wow.
It is actually a lot better. But I would not recommend the console version of this game at this point in time. Next on the list, though, is one that everyone everywhere should play. This is Marvel Ultimate Alliance.
Yes!
This hit for the PlayStation 2, PlayStation 3, Xbox 360, Wii, Game Boy Advance, PSP, and PC. This is the spiritual successor to the X-Men Legends games. Much like what we saw Capcom do, start with the X-Men, then build around the whole Marvel universe. That's what Activision did here. And so you now have a game that is just this huge, almost Diablo clone, but like RPG team style game. Has a pretty interesting story. Tons and tons and tons of comic book Easter eggs. It has bonus levels based on like classic comic book arcs. Huge, huge selection of characters. Just a great game. To me, if you've never played Marvel Ultimate Alliance and you have any interest in the Marvel universe, and games, you have to play Marvel Ultimate Alliance.
Yeah, it's really accessible, really fun. Like, I mean,
Oh, this is the one game on the list where I feel like you've probably played more than me.
Yeah, I mean, I just really, and I was never really, you know, a huge Diablo fan. Not like I didn't like Diablo, I just never really had been super interested in it. And it was probably actually this game that made me look into, you know, Diablo 3 instead of the other way around.
Oh, wow. Now, see, that's definitely different from what you typically hear. In 2007, we got a Spider-Man 3 game for Game Boy Advance, Windows, Nintendo DS, PlayStation 2, PlayStation 3, PlayStation Portable, Wii, Xbox 360, TV games, and mobile phones. It was, you know, more of the same as the other Spider-Man movie games. Not very much iteration or, you know, advancement, unfortunately. It's not really an evolution, it's just more of the same. We also got Fantastic Four Rise of the Silver Surfer, based on the movie of the same game for Nintendo DS, Wii, Xbox 360, PlayStation 2, and PlayStation 3. I'm not a fan. I'm not a fan. Following that, though, we had Spider-Man Friend or Foe in 2007 for the 360, PlayStation 2, DS, Wii, Windows, and PlayStation Portable, along with PlayStation Web of Shadows, Spider-Man Web of Shadows. It was that font that threw me off. Ba-dunce.
Ah!
But, you know, these two games, they're both pretty silly, not super, super well-designed necessarily, but fun games if you're looking for a cheap evening, turn off your brain and play a game. But at this point, we start to see licensed movie games really become a big deal. There was an Incredible Hulk game in 2008 that was actually pretty competent, made by Sega for the DS, PlayStation 2, PlayStation 3, Wii, Windows, and Xbox 360. It was actually not bad. The problem is, we had just had an Incredible Hulk game that was really good, and so by contrast, it seemed like a failure. There was also an Iron Man game in 2008 for those same platforms, pretty much. And unfortunately, that one was not super well done. But the hidden jewel of these licensed movie games was the X-Men Origins Wolverine game. This hit in 2009. I actually mentioned it in our most recent episode prior to this, because you can't really get it in any of the online stores anymore. But this is for PlayStation 2, PlayStation 3, Xbox 360, Wii, Nintendo DS, PC, and PSP. I have the PC version. I actually own a disc of it because you can't buy it on Steam anymore. And it is a super, super competent God of War clone, basically, based in the X-Men movie universe. But it has a ton of little cute Easter eggs for, like, Marvel Comics fans. And even Easter eggs, like, there's a really great Lost Easter egg. There's an amazing WoW Easter egg where you can find Shadowmourne in it.
Oh, wow.
Because, you know, Acta Blizz.
Yeah.
But more than that, like, the combat is really tight. Like, the enemy variety is good. You actually have, like, interesting enemy encounters. It's actually, like, a legit great game. And that was followed by a Punisher game for PlayStation 3 in 2009, released by Zen Studios, called Punisher No Mercy. It was a well-designed PSN experience, first-person shooter game, and it was really good, but unfortunately it was delisted from PSN just like a year and a half after it released, which sucks, because it was actually like a really cool first-person shooter game. Luckily, things got a little bit better after that, overall, because we then got Marvel Ultimate Alliance 2 in 2009 as well for the PlayStation 3, Xbox 360, Wii, DS, PSP platforms. And Slaggy, I believe you've also played a lot of Ultimate Alliance 2?
Not as much, but yeah, you know, a lot of people, I feel like a lot of people are reading a lot of reviews out there, or maybe just based on the Metacritic. I feel like it wasn't as well received, but it wasn't that bad. I mean, I think that, you know, if you only played one, play Marvel Ultimate Alliance, the original, but yeah, well, I mean, it
Ultimate Alliance 2 had a focus on, like, combining attacks with your friends, and I guess it bothered people that it was super non-canon or something, but I thought it was fun. 2010 saw the release of Spider-Man Shattered Dimensions for Xbox 360, PlayStation 3, Microsoft Windows, Wii, and Nintendo DS. This is one that, where the console version is one that I definitely am a fan of. I think I may have talked about it on the show before, but I may not have. Shattered Dimensions was basically like a Spider-Man crosses the multiverse game.
Yeah.
Not entirely dissimilar to what's going on in the Marvel comics right now.
There's a poster of it here at Game Boy Studios.
Yeah, there is, there is. It has, you know, Spider-Man Noir is in it, Spider-Man 2099 is in it, some other alternate universe Spider-Mans are in it, and they all have to come together to stop a threat. But something that's cool, before they come together, when everyone is, like, the different multiversal Spider-Mans, they all have extremely different level design and even, like, play styles. Like, they feel like different games for each Spider-Man. So one is, like, an action game, one is, like, a, like, acrobatics flying, soaring through the skies, avoiding enemies game, one is, like, a hardcore, like, stealth game. Like, it's just, it's a really cool, diverse experience that I would highly recommend, and it's a pretty cheap game to play, so I would recommend you look into that one. We also got Marvel Superhero Squad, The Infinity Gauntlet, which is a Xbox 360, PlayStation 3, Wii, Nintendo DS, Nintendo 3DS game. I've only played the 3DS version of this, but it was like a fun, cute 4Kids beat-em-up with a ton
hopefully
of
not a 4Kids like 4Kids Entertainment.
What was that?
Hopefully not 4Kids like 4Kids Entertainment.
No, not 4Kids like 4Kids Entertainment. There was a Iron Man 2 game based on the Iron Man 2 movie for 360, PlayStation 3, Wii, PlayStation Portable, DS, iOS. I only played the DS version, and I did not think it was very good. There was also Spider-Man Edge of Time, which was sort of loosely a sequel to Spider-Man Shattered Dimensions, except this one focused only on Spider-Man and Spider-Man 2099. I'm a huge Spider-Man 2099 fan. I got to meet Peter David, who writes Spider-Man 2099, at a panel for this game at a convention. I'm a little biased, but I think it's a good game and that it's worth playing. Unfortunately, in 2011, the same year as Edge of Time came out, we also got X-Men Destiny. X-Men Destiny, in short, is the game that tanked Silicon Knights, the game studio that has...
We've had articles about it that we discussed.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, X-Men Destiny is a fucking shit show. It's worth playing as Kusoge, and, you know, if I'm being really honest, there are some things I like about it just because I'm a gigantic X-Men fan. I effing love X-Men so much. So, X-Men Destiny, it's non-canon, and a lot of characters act super out of character in the story of the game. It's a poorly designed game. The mechanics are all broken and gross, and the graphics are ugly and stupid, and I still don't regret buying it because it's X-Men. If you feel that way about X-Men, you should probably get into it. If you don't, stay the fuck away because it's not even fun for being bad. But in 2011, something very magical happened, and Marvel got to make a third versus... Capcom got to make a third versus Marvel game. This was, of course, Marvel versus Capcom 3, Fate of Two Worlds. It is a, 2D, 3D fighting game that is, really well received by the fighting game community. It ousted Marvel vs. Capcom 2 in competitive play, which is always a big deal in the fighting game community. You know, sometimes a sequel to a fighting game comes out and the fighting community is just like, don't really care that much. But no,
who cares?
Right? But MVC3, gets a lot of play, even still. People like it. It's generally a well-designed, well-balanced game. Unfortunately, Capcom shot themselves in the foot and released an update to it in Ultimate Marvel vs. Capcom 3 just like 7 months after the release of the original. And while this was a great update, it added like 4 characters on each side of the roster, like 4 new Marvels, 4 new Capcoms, including some characters that should have been there in the first fucking place, like Strider Hiryu, really burnt a lot of goodwill. It is worth mentioning, that game, you can't buy it on the PSN or Xbox Live Arcade shops anymore. But there is a really stupendous PlayStation Vita port of Ultimate Marvel vs. Capcom 3. If you're looking for a 2D fighting game on the go, Ultimate Marvel vs. Capcom 3 is about as, like, console-perfect as it gets for fighting games on the go. Let's see, there was a Thor God of Thunder game. This was for the PlayStation 3, Xbox 360, Nintendo DS, Wii, and Nintendo 3DS. I only played the Nintendo DS version because it had some really amazing sprite work. It's actually a sprite-based 2D platformer, and it's not awful. It's not great, but the sprite work made it worth my while. And second verse, same as the first, for the other 2011 game, Captain America Super Soldier. We start to go back to sort of earlier Spider-Man-style games with the release of 2012's Amazing Spider-Man. This is, of course, based on Amazing Spider-Man the movie.
With the cutie, Peter?
Yeah, with Andrew Garfield.
Yeah, sorry, Toby. Andrew Garfield's cuter.
It released on Nintendo DS, PlayStation 3, Wii, Wii U, Xbox 360, Nintendo 3DS, Windows, Android, and iOS platforms. Once again, Spider-Man, open world, plot based loosely on the movie, some weird random appearances by non-movie characters. It's not bad, it's just, unfortunately, that formula was done best in Ultimate Spider-Man for Xbox, PS2, GameCube, and all of these other games. They basically just do the same thing, except more rigidly adhering to movie plots, so that all of the cool extra characters and stuff come out of left field, and it's like an uncomfortable mishmash that's like, why am I fighting this weird version of Electro, and then over here I'm fighting like the Shocker and Carnage and Venom? Like, that's a way higher priority than like weirdo Electro. So it's unfortunate that the Spider-Man games have gone that way. Ultimate remains the one to go to, but none of them are really bad. I'll talk about that a little bit more because I did some specific research on the Amazing Spider-Man 2 for PlayStation 4, which we'll talk about in a few minutes. But we have to get there. We have a couple more games. There was a Marvel vs. Capcom Origins release. Unfortunately, it's been delisted. This was, what was it? Marvel vs. Capcom 1. And Marvel Super Heroes.
Yeah.
That was for PlayStation 3 and Xbox 360 by Capcom. Great release. If you have it, cool. If you don't, I'm really sorry. Activision in 2013 released a pretty cool Deadpool game that was notable for being available on Steam and stuff for, what, like 5 or 6 months before
it was delisted. Right, we just talked about it the other week.
It was also available on PlayStation 3, Xbox 360. It was a very competent character action game with an amazing script.
Well, I would hope a Deadpool game would have a good script.
Yeah, it is exactly, as far as like the presentation and story, it is exactly what you would want out of a Deadpool game. It is hilarious.
Well, Deadpool game, I didn't get around to playing it, but I can imagine it, like, the tutorial mode would be very, like, it would make sense in-game that he would be telling you, like, press this button to move me.
Yeah, no, and that's it exactly. And it's actually really cool in that regard. The character action fighting stuff is a little weak, but overall it's a good package. I own the game, and I'm glad I do. We also had LEGO Marvel Super Heroes in 2003 for the Xbox 360, PlayStation 3,
fun time.
Wii U, DS, 3DS, Vita, Windows, PlayStation 4, Xbox One, OS X, and PC by Traveler Tales Games. And that sort of starts the next era of games for us that we're going to be discussing here. But it is, to me, the most complete of the LEGO franchise games. It has an absurd number of playable characters, including some that are just, like, really weird little-known one-off characters. Like, why would you include that? But that actually adds to the game's whimsy and charm.
Yeah, it's actually really cute.
And overall, overall, yeah, it's a lot of fun. It's very pleasant. And for me, that was actually the first LEGO game I got really into.
I remember that because I'd been like, oh, you haven't played LEGO, blah, blah, blah. You're like, no. And then you're like, oh, okay, these are pretty cool.
Yeah. And then we come, of course, to the 2014 release of Amazing Spider-Man 2 to coincide with the Amazing Spider-Man 2 movie. This released for Windows, 3DS, PlayStation 3, PlayStation 4, Wii U, Xbox 360, Xbox One, iOS, and Android.
So is it Amazing Spider-Man number 2?
Yeah, so I bought a copy of this game knowing it was bad. It got so many bad reviews. All of my friends who played it were like, it's awful. Unfortunately, I played it, like, I bought it for this episode, and I wish I hadn't. It is fucking abysmal. And, you know, I mean, I say that, I have to temper it with the fact, again, it's a bog-standard Spider-Man game, but they changed the way his webbing works to try and make it, like, a little bit more active, and it just comes out, like, really jank. Normally, you know, Spider-Man has, like, a button for webs, and you press it, and you're webbing across town, it's fun. This one requires, like, this is your button for your left web slinger, this is your button for your right web swinger. And you have to sort of, like, look at buildings and, like, oh, is that building on my right? I better use my right web swinger. And, like, in theory, it's a cool idea. It's kind of physics-based, and, like, there's a whole, like, web speed, like, idea and mechanic based on, like, oh, if you release your button while he's in the middle of his arc, he'll come out going faster but with less altitude. It's, like, a really cool concept, but unfortunately for what the game wants you to do, which is largely, like, find this one random mook that is in the middle of a super small alleyway. Like, you don't really get to use those fun traversal mechanics. The game really encourages you to, like, use the traversal mechanics to get in the general area and then, like, explore on foot, which is, like, the point of Spider-Man isn't to go fucking on foot. The point of Spider-Man is to, like, web swing over the person, drop in on them in a kick, like, knock them out, web them up, and leave them for the police to find.
Yeah.
So it's just one of those things where it's like, they went over their head to try and, like, add depth to the gameplay, and to me, ended up losing focus of, like, what's fun about Spider-Man. And
then, it's basically Assassin's Web.
Kind of. And then you pair that with, in fact, it's funny you say that, the combat system.
Because, like, how Assassin's Creed, like, basically got less and less, like, stealthy assassinations, and it's like, oh, you've got to do hand-to-hand combat.
Well, it's funny you say that, because the combat system is super Assassin's Creed-y. It even has, like, a counter button that you press when people are, like, coming at you, then you, like, auto-attack them if you press the parry button in the right timing. It felt like I was playing a Spider-Man-skinned Assassin's Creed.
Oh, God.
I was not impressed. Maybe I'm being too harsh on the game. I only paid, like, $8 for it, but...
Oh, thank goodness.
But I was very disappointed. And, you know, I try not to graphics whore, but I do have to say, like, I was playing a PlayStation 4 game that looked like a PlayStation 2 game.
Oh!
On the other side of things, we have Disney Infinity Marvel Super Heroes, which, yeah, of course, was Xbox One, PlayStation 360, PlayStation 4, PlayStation 3, PlayStation Vita, Wii U, Microsoft Windows. We've talked a lot about Disney Infinity. You already know what it's about if you listen to this show. Overall, I'm a fan.
Disney Infinity, you already know.
I like the Marvel stuff. I love, love, love the character designs for the Marvel characters in this game.
Yeah.
Toy designs for, I just think it's really cool artistically what they did. The gameplay is a little shallow, but, you know, it's better than the Amazing Spider-Man 2. And last, but certainly not least for this main chunk of the episode, we have the upcoming LEGO Marvel's Avengers. This appears to be a sequel to LEGO Marvel Super Heroes, more focused on the Marvel movie franchises. So, it's definitely one that we will be playing here in studio and about later this year when it releases for the Xbox 360, Xbox One, PlayStation 3, PlayStation 4, Wii U, Vita, 3DS, and PC. There are also a handful of footnotes I have here to talk about. Of course, there are a ton of iOS/casual games in the Marvel Universe. Most of them are not really worth talking about, and I don't really plan on talking about them. But I did want to call special attention to Marvel Contest Quest of Champions, which is a kind of cool, like, fighting style game for Android and iOS. It is free to play. I'd recommend you check it out. There is a really cool 2D beat-em-up called Guardians of the Galaxy, the Universal Weapon, which, when I played it, it cost like $2.99. I think it may have gone free to play since then, but either way, I actually had a lot of fun with it. I would recommend you check it out. Obviously, there was Marvel Avengers Alliance for Facebook, which was huge. Like, people still
play that game. Oh, I remember you were so into that.
And it plays basically like a JRPG, just with Marvel characters, so, you know, it's pretty aight. And my beloved Marvel Puzzle Quest, which I am still playing every day for hours at a time. In the MMO space, we have Marvel Superhero Squad Online, which is meant to play as sort of like a My First MMO.
Yeah.
And the incredible Marvel Heroes, which was a 2013 MMO release. It's very much a Diablo clone. It was designed by the guy who designed Diablo 2. It brings some of the ideas from Marvel Ultimate Alliance to the table.
Yeah, I don't know why I haven't played it yet.
It is so good. I love it. I play it all the freaking time. It's absolutely like a mainstay of my gaming diet these days. It's one of the few like free-to-play games that like I've actually paid a lot of money to their cash shop to buy new characters because the game is so well designed, I feel really good about buying new characters for it. There was also a really good Spider-Man Super Famicom game that never came to North America. There were very few Marvel Comics games that didn't come out in North America. Not super hard to tell why, but this one, Spider-Man Lethal Foes, is just a really competent 2D action platformy game. There was a lot of like Spider-Man lore characters, which were really cool, characters that weren't like necessarily popular in Spider-Man media, like the animated show or whatever, that for some reason in this game that was super randomly based on the 1993 arc, The Lethal Foes of Spider-Man, like, this game was just really cool. And really funny. It had a lot of, like, English-y stuff in the title sequences, which is cool. Yeah, I'm always into that kind of stuff. And it's really weird to me that this game stayed in Japan. I still don't really understand why that happened.
Well, Japan loves Spider-Man, right?
Oh, that's true, yeah. Yeah, that's definitely true.
Something Super Sentai.
Ah, yeah, there was. There was a Sentai Spider-Man. In fact, he was brought back in the recent Spider-Verse comics story that was...
Are you for real?
Super good. He even had his giant robot Leopard. And Leopardon fucking saved the day more than once.
Aww.
Yeah, it's so good. And the last interesting thing about Lethal Foes is that it even had, like, unlockable content by scanning in barcodes using the Barcode Battler 2 interface for Super Famicom. So it's just, like, a really weird thing. If you find a Famicom card of it, I would definitely recommend you play it. If you're into that emulator life, well, I don't mind looking the other way. Slaggy, so we had a question of the week that went out this week about this topic. Now would probably be the time to discuss it.
All right, so our social links question of the week was, this week we're talking about our favorite games based on Marvel Comics comics. Do you have a favorite? And the Facebook bonus question was, which Marvel franchise has not yet been turned into a game that you would like to see in video game form? We got a response from Nathan BL, who has a special Readiness Fundamental nickname.
That we will not be bringing up here.
We will not be stating up here. And his response was, I've always liked the Gauntlet/Diablo-like games, X-Men Legends 1 and 2. Being able to play as Storm and Gambit and Scarlet Witch were exactly what I wanted from a Marvel game. More recently, I still really like Ultimate Marvel vs. Capcom 3. It turned me on to Doctor Strange, but that Gambit is apt and still makes me sad. Doctor Strange should get his own game. I picture it having a spell blending system like Magicka.
I love your thought process. I am 100% with you here.
That'd be fun.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was it?
Yep.
Okay, well, Slaggy, how about you answer these questions? What's your favorite, and what would you like to see?
Favorite is easily Marvel Ultimate Alliance. You know, if I had to pick just the one, it would be the original one, but, you know, just that whole, range. So I'm definitely in the same territory as Nathan BL. As far as what I'd like to see, you know, I'm not the hugest comics nerd, and it's not out of even anything like, oh, comics. It's just that I don't have a huge knowledge base.
Yeah, no, I've shoved tons of comics in your direction. You've received them well, so.
But, I mean, I'd love to see, the type of shit that I would like to see would be like, LOL, like, oh, let's have a Dazzler music/action RPG video game.
You know, you say that, but Capcom made a game called PN number 03. And, like, if that were a Dazzler game, it would be amazing. Like, you could just take that exact game design and just put Dazzler in, and it would be the perfect game.
Oh, really?
Yeah, seriously. Like, the game is already, like, move to the rhythm, do everything to the rhythm, fire to the rhythm. So to, like, just plug Dazzler in there would be fine and amazing.
See, but mine would also have, like, you'd be singing or something. This is why I'm not a game designer. I'm like, you'd be singing, so you'd have to wear, like, your headset while you're going, like, pew, pew, zoom, zoom.
All right.
Firing my lasers.
Yeah, for me, you know, my favorite is probably Marvel vs. Capcom 3, Ultimate Marvel vs. Capcom 3. I love that game. I think it's an incredibly designed fighting game. Tons of my favorite characters are in it. But I also have to give special shout-outs to Captain America and the Avengers, Spider-Man the video game, X-Men 1992 by Konami.
You know,
like, these are some games that really were, for me, they defined my childhood, practically. You know, I've made no secret, I grew up in an arcade, definitely in a situation with, like, oh, here's some money, stop bothering us, just play your games.
You literally grew up in an arcade, you slept in the hoops, the basketball hot hoops.
That part didn't happen. So, you know, I definitely played a lot of these games. And for me, you know, a lot of my tastes and interests in games were defined by these three games. So, I'm a big fan. I absolutely love them. And I would love, what I would really love to see would be if Marvel could work with Sega, work with Data East, work with Konami, and put out, like, a Marvel Arcade Classics.
Oh, okay.
I would love more than anything to see Captain America and the Avengers, Spider-Man the video game, and X-Men 92 available again for players on current consoles so that we could play these amazing games. But, you know, the reality here is what I'd really love, including that, is really just to see most of these games come to Virtual Console and PSN and Xbox Live. You know, the Capcom Super Nintendo games, the War of the Gems and Mutant Apocalypse are both, like, just superb games that it really sucks that more people can't play. Obviously, you know, the Genesis Sega-made X-Men games, X-Men and X-Men Clone Wars, both so good. I want these games to come back. And if I have to pick an all-new game, I'll just give the cheap answer and just say Marvel vs. Capcom 4.
That's not answering the bonus question, though.
I thought the bonus question was, what game do you want to see made?
No, it's like, what franchise has not been represented in games? Or, like, you know, not...
Next Wave.
Okay.
If any of our listeners know what Next Wave is, they're probably cackling.
To be fair,
everyone else is like, what the fuck is a Next Wave?
To be fair, I said Dazzler, who was in the X-Men arcade game, but, you know, she didn't have her own game.
Fair.
Do you think Miss Marvel will get a game?
Do I think Miss Marvel will get a game? I do. But she did make a cameo in the Guardians of the Galaxy, the Universal Weapon iOS game.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah. Miss Marvel's rad. As an X-Men fan, I never thought I would say that, but I'm there today. Alright, well, let's wrap this up because we are deep into this episode and we still have a little ways to go. In fact, we have a couple of smashes for you today. So, Saigi, you're done with the discussion, yeah?
Yeah.
Alright, well then, let's discuss this first one. This is an article on US Gamer. It is an interview with Koji Igarashi-san about Bloodstained: Ritual of the Night. I highly, highly, highly recommend you check this out. You know, we're always on the lookout for, like, really great articles, well-written pieces, and this is an interview about Bloodstained that basically asks all of the questions that were dying on our minds when Bloodstained was announced. I highly recommend you look into it. Igarashi-san is a man who thinks about things before he answers. He has a lot of deep insight into the Japanese games industry. And as opposed to certain other Japanese media games personalities, he's actually pretty humble about his place in the game design, and also has a pretty interesting perspective on the direction that the industry is going in Japan.
Yeah, definitely.
There was also a really fun piece, and, you know, it doesn't necessarily have a lot of value, objectively speaking, but it was just, for me, this was a fun editorial. When I look at, like, how a lot of game sites are very bloggy, they have a lot of editorial content, and a lot of it is like, are you really writing an article about why it bothers you that there was a packet of Kit Kat bars in a game you played recently? Like, I'm sorry, get over it. This, though, was a really cute story about why the writer collects used memory cards and just likes to look over other other people's saves and, you know, just have a moment of, like, thinking about the different experiences people have playing games. JRPGs, the way people, like, rename characters differently, and sometimes it's just, like, LOL butts, but sometimes they're, like, personal names. It's just, it's one of those things, it's just a really interesting exercise to think about how differently some people play games these days. I thought it was a really cute piece, and
yeah,
it
really
actually kind of made me want to do this. So, you know, again, we're always on the lookout to link you guys to things that are cute reads, things that are fun to read, things that, you know, are what we want to see in the game writing sphere. And this, for me, is the kind of editorial that I enjoy seeing. So, you know, we're linking it to you over as a smash.
Indeed.
Slaggy, unless you have anything else, I think it's time to start the wind down.
Thankfully. Let's do it.
All right. Well, as ever and always, let's talk about...
I said, hey, what's going on?
Slaggy, do you want to start us off this week? What have you been playing?
I've been playing the sleep game where you go to sleep because I've been trying to fight off a cold.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah, so it's a total bummer. I've not really had any gaming time in. Did I talk about resubbing to WoW last time?
You have talked about it here.
Okay, yeah, so I haven't really done much with that since.
Have you played any more Star Trek, Star Wars, The Old Republic?
Not yet, but I've been really eager to, especially with the, you know, 12x XP that we got from the May the 4th Be With You. So, you know, I've got gaming on the mind, but it's just, unfortunately, like, this past week just has not happened.
Aw. All right, well, let's see. Since our last episode, I was talking about how I had played Aria of Sorrow for Slagkick to make him watch the whole game, see how the game design unfolded. That put me in a Metroidvania mood, so I...
Excuse me, Igavania.
So I played and completed the entirety of Symphony of the Night, Dawn of Sorrow, which is the DS sequel to Aria of Sorrow, and Portrait of Ruin, which only took me like 2 days, because that game is a easy, breezy, beautiful cover girl. So next up, I'm going to do Order of Ecclesia, and I just, man, I fucking love these games so much. Let's see, what else have I been playing? I've been playing Destiny again, checking out the House of Wolves, which is all that everyone is saying. I played a little more Bloodborne, I played a little more Star Wars, I played a little more Smash Brothers, and I played a little more Mario Galaxy 2. I'm nearing the end, I think. And that's, you know, that's my gaming life right now. Oh, I also bought a fucking Wonderswan, finally.
I'm like, I haven't played any games in the past week and a half. You're like, oh, blah, 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 and I imported a Wonderswan.
Yeah, well, that's my life.
I'm not. I'm not making fun of you. I'm just saying, damn it, you're making me look bad.
Oh, sorry. I mean, I didn't play much this week. I don't know. Social links. Do we have any?
We've got a few social links. So we got a little nibble of social media to share with you. In response to you talking about feeling sassy editing the last episode of Game Buoy and having a beer, Oh Hey DJ on Twitter said, yes, come through!
Oh, I did, bitch.
And we also got some nice feedback about some recent episodes. First up is Emiru69 over on Twitter saying, some episode, personally I'm so done with Amiibo, I just don't have the time or the money, but I enjoyed the talk. So thank you. I'm glad you enjoyed our talk about, you know, supply and demand in gaming.
Yeah, thank you so much for that feedback. I appreciate it. You know, I've heard a couple of people have said things somewhat pleasant to me about that episode, and that's surprising because I was actually worried that it had gone too far with that one. So thank you all so much.
And over on Facebook, in response to our last episode about delisting games and such, we had a response from our dear friend Amanda, who you might have heard on the Party Games Games Party episode, saying digital rights, especially in gaming, is a huge issue. It sets a precedent for how we are going to interact with digital goods in the future, such as games, ebooks, videos, and more. If I buy a game on Steam or book on Kindle and they decide to take it away, you better believe I would be pissed. Oh, and we know you would, honey.
Oh, I've met you. You're pissed even when things go your way.
Ooh, girl. She's going to be pissed now. But
yeah, she is.
In all seriousness, totally agree, Amanda. And I was just thinking about that since this, you know, last episode. Like, it's kind of problematic in a lot of ways. And, you know, I can see this turning out to be really, you know, I can imagine some really bad situations coming from this, so... So controversial.
Yeah, and you know, that's something that I was sort of trying to talk about that episode as well. Like, what we're seeing in games, and I'm not sure why this is happening in games sooner than it's happening in music or movies or whatever, but this is ground that is going to be covered as media in general goes more and more in the direction of being digital only, online only, streaming, etc., etc. Basically, at what point after you've purchased, quote-unquote, purchased content, at what point is it okay for the people you purchased it from to take it back or delete it? Because, you know, obviously it's like a whole huge thing that you've heard over the last few years where people are basically like, oh, we don't own anything anymore, we're just licensing the use of it. And the real definition of these ideas is something that is really going to shape so much in the coming years. And that's something that Amanda's really on point about, is this is a big deal, and we're just seeing it happen in games a little sooner than we're seeing it happen anywhere else for some reason.
It's true that. And with that, we love your feedback.
We fucking love it.
We love your iTunes subscriptions, ratings, and reviews. We like your Facebook likes. We fucking love Twitter.
Love Twitter.
I'm sorry, Tumblr and Google Plus. If you're out there and I'm neglecting you, I accept the full blame. We obviously have a preference for Facebook and Twitter. I'm sorry, but we love you if you're listening to us on those other platforms. Hearts, 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 and I will do my best to increase our social media presence on there. You can check us out on Stitcher Radio. You can email us at gamebuoy.org.
Mailbuoy@gamebuoy.org.
To mailbuoy@gamebuoy.org, who is a pirate piplup.
Mailbuoy@gamebuoy.org.
Ooh, did pirate piplup evolve into a pirate Empoleon?
He had the change of life.
Yeah, I guess so. Of course, you can find everything over on our home base, gamebuoy.org.
Gamebuoy.org.
Our complete episode archive, our current game bloggy, and any future game bloggies. And, you know, if you are someone who's going back through all those backlog of episode, then you should really feel free to mail mailbuoy@gamebuoy.org.
Mailbuoy@gamebuoy.org.
We always love to hear your thoughts. You know, this show would not be possible without you. We would just be kind of broadcasting into a vacuum, like literally, like, you know, a Dyson or a, you know, one of those.
A Dyson. LOL, as if we can afford all that.
Like one of those little,
It's like a Black and Decker.
A little dust devil.
Yeah, right? It's a dirt devil.
Yeah. So we'd really like to thank you so much for, you know, tuning in 80 episodes strong. We wouldn't be here without you, and we wouldn't be here without the support of our fellow podcasters, such as...
As ever and always, my first shout-out goes to VG Realness, serving up a weekly dose of gaming chit-chat among friends, as well as the Game Over Takeover, your one-stop shop to go to for geekery galore. I'd be remiss not to mention Orange Lounge Radio, where every gamer has a voice, and from whom I've stolen ever so many of my cues. I'd also like to point you in the direction of the Nintendo Fun Club, your place for platformers, positivity, and pop punk, as well as their sister show, Enos Lives, where you'll get your, I don't want to say weekly, but fairly regular dose of PlayStation 1 love, as well as the Nintendo Love Fest, which is co-hosted by Anthony of X Nation, which you'll find over at culturalwormhole.blogspot.com, an awesome podcast focusing on Marvel's Mighty Mutants. In other non-gaming podcasts, I would also guide you in the direction of Reading is Fundamental. That is, of course, Slagkick's show about RuPaul's Drag Race, featuring myself, Rob Roberts from Orange Lounge Radio, and Delvin from VG Realness. We have a lot of fun on that show, and if you're listening to this and not that, even if you don't like Drag Race, you might enjoy it. We have a lot of banter. That's like our silly show. Also, of course, is the Starboard Power Coupling podcast, the Star Trek podcast you hope doesn't fail. And last but never, 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 ever least, Tables, Ladders, and Podcast, a professional wrestling podcast for the common man. Slaggy, you know where to take us.
Game Bar is the gay
video... Take us to a game bar!
Excuse me. Game Bar is the gay video game Prairie Home Companion and a part of the Hunty Bunch. I'd also like to shout out to Koopa Club. That's Koopa with a Q and Club with a K. Koopa Club is an award-winning podcast about Nintendo and gaming with an LGBT twist. I believe the award was from their mothers. Over on the Voice of Geeks Network at VogNetwork.com, along with Orange Lounge Radio and the Starboard Power Coupling Podcast, and some other great shows. You can hear Girls Gone WoW, where you can get a female perspective on the world's most popular MMO. And Horde House, the place for all things online gaming, but never too seriously. But every once in a while, they can be kind of serious. Over on FistfulOfPotions.com, I'd like to shout out to Princess Irene's show that she is a co-host on, and that is the Multi-Tap Podcast, a podcast discussion in the round about gaming then and now. And last but certainly not least, I'd like to give a warm shout out to La Palanca Podcast, podcast por y para gay gamers latinoamericanos en español, and a product of the podcast Crosszone panel.
Nah, they're awesome. They have surpassed us.
They hold a special place in my heart.
Aw, okay, well that is super cute.
Hey! As everyone always, our wonderful theme music was done by the late, great Zelda Reorchestrated, the project that aimed to reorchestrate beautiful Zelda music into gorgeous symphonic sound. They unfortunately closed their gates and lifted the drawbridge to their Hyrule Castle. Will be forever pouring out a 40 into their great fairy fountain.
Well, with all that having been said, our lovely and beautiful listeners, thank you for spending this beautiful Sunday afternoon with us. We deeply, deeply appreciate it. We're going to be back in your ear holes pretty soon with some fantastic, E3 coverage. Before that, we'll probably have an episode or two about one or two interesting things. Possibly, if I can convince Slagkick to do it, even a look at Metroidvanias. However, regardless of what we come back with next, until then, keep gaming, keep thinking, and I'm the messenger from hell, Spider-Man.
Wait, Spider-Man went to hell?
Testing, testing, testing. Hot mics, hot mics.
Get your hot mics, get your hot mics. Bryce Harper has got a hot microphone in his pants.
Everything.
If you would like to fund Game Buoy Biatch, my new indie game, please head over to my Indiegogo.
Pieces. Controversial topics to discuss in our...
Wow.
I was certified hot.
Just continue with the article, please. All right, so our social links question of the week. So we have a little snippet.
Not snippet. A little, snack.